Okay, my name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And thank you, Karen, for calling me this afternoon and asking me to share. Now, that was your second choice, eh? Pride. So, like, I've been taught, actually, since I came in, that when somebody asks you to do something, you basically do it. That's just the way that my first serious sponsor worked it. So here I am. How it was, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in Montreal. I'm the sixth of seven children. I've got five brothers and a sister. The way things were at home, apparently I was like a handful from the age of 6 months, so my mother tells me I was always on the go. I can neither confirm nor deny that. Eh? I don't remember what it was like when I was 6 months. My earliest memories are probably when I was three, four years old. I remember nursery schools and things like that. And I also, like, from an early age, I remember feeling uncomfortable. What I now believe was just the beginning of, I guess, fear. Fear in social situations. It was like that in elementary school. Happy-go-lucky, but just always like kind of feeling, I guess, a little bit out of the loop. I have like four older brothers. I used to always like to, you know, pal around with them when I was young. But I mean, that didn't really last too long because there's a pretty large age difference from oldest brother to my youngest brother, who's like 7 years younger than me. Yeah, first experience was therapy. I was in grade two. Apparently, my parents thought that I had some behavioral problems. And, if I was feeling a little apart from then, I felt like that confirmed it. Going through elementary school, high school came up. I went to a private school and didn't want to go there, but my older brothers had gone there. I suppose that's when, like, a lot of the deliberate stuff started. I started stealing money from my folks at a very early age, probably in about grade six. I'd go into my mother's purse and slip out money, and I'd like to treat my friends. That was, I guess, one way that I would get along with people, you know, like gain their approval by buying things. By the time I was in grade eight, I was picking up. That's when I started smoking. Smoked a little pot after my secondary two exams. Later that summer, I ended up having some apple cider next to a synagogue. I enjoyed it. It was, you know, just to be part of the gang, huh? Moving along, when I was about 15 years old or so, the drugs, you know, like drugs are part of my story. That's just the way it is. And I grew up in Montreal in a time that there was a lot of hash around, and I had no problem stealing money to basically buy that and treat my friends. Some petty crime started at that point. I'd gotten kicked out of the private school and moved gone over to the public school in our area, like up in NDG Marymount. And I lasted there about 3 months. All sorts of crap was happening. Like, I mean, from a very early in my story, you know, one was never enough. If it was like a joint or a beer or a booze, you know, it was always, one was never enough. Huh? I always pushed the limits. Stole medications. My father was a doctor. I stole medications from his pharmacy, and it was like, here, you know, like that's the way that I would gain approval, eh? And feel part of. Didn't last too long in the city. Things were like really spinning out of control at the age of 15, 16, and my folks shipped me out of town, and I finished my high school at a boarding school. And it was a great place. We went up there during the week and came home on the weekends, and we'd always end up in somebody's basement on the weekends with a case of beer and you know, some pot or some hash. So that's the way that it went. I ended up getting through high school, no problem, and it's time to make it in the city. I went to Vanier Snowden. I lasted there maybe about half a semester, and this is when my daily drinking really started. There was a brasserie across the street, the Snowden Brasserie, and I ended up spending more time there and kind of hooked in with one of my older brother's friends. And that's when I was introduced to cocaine. It's part of my story. I used everything all the way through my entire story. Ended up getting a job, good job, working in a hospital, taking care of people as an orderly, and I enjoyed that. I felt like I had purpose. I was good at it. It was a way of me understanding illness, you know, that it... My father, when I was about 16 or 17 years old, got sick. He had Parkinson's. And being a surgeon, that wasn't really good. And I basically watched him erode for like another 9 years with that. Home wasn't a very happy place. Whenever it came to, you know, like dealing with stuff at home, it was always volatile. I can remember my mother always being a bitter woman. I remember when my grandfather got sick when I was about 11 or 12 years old. And she was into her cups then, and a usual evening in the house was her, you know, sitting there drinking and berating my father. I mean, we were considered like a great family, you know. On the outside, everybody thought everything was cool. How can you go wrong? Nice family. Father's a doctor, mother's a nurse, successful brothers, and but behind the doors, it was like a really miserable place. Never really knew how to deal with that, and I suppose not being there and hanging out in the bar was my escape, and that's what happened. So I escaped for a long time, for a good 16 or 17 years. My father, my first experience with rehab, I never really dealt with change very well, and in my job, I had shifted from one particular job to part of the hospital to another. And I didn't really deal with that so well. And that fear, that anxiety that I always kind of had all the way through my life, it was always there just in my gut. You know, just at different times it would intensify. So would my drinking and my drugging. my first experience with rehab was when I was about 25, 26 years old. When I was going through this change at work, I wasn't able to make it in. People were starting to notice that I wasn't showing up as regularly. I always had great excuses, but bottom line, I was never really sick that much. I was just like really hungover in the mornings. So I couldn't really make it. Did the 28-day program up in Ottawa. It was placed through the Royal Ottawa Hospital, Metal Creek. And they told me at that point that I was an end-stage addict, and if I didn't change, I was going to die. And I said, okay, well, you know, I'll play ball here. I'll jump through the hoops so I can keep my job, and everything will be fine. I stuck with the aftercare there for about 2 or 3 weeks. I came out and decided that, you know, drugs were my problem. Coke was my problem. But drinking would be okay within a couple of weeks. No, I didn't really do. They forced us to go to meetings on our weekends back, and I did that. But it never really clicked once I was back in Montreal full time. I always liked to play my cards in the sense that, you know, to get special treatment, I was able to manipulate my schedule. I would, you know, easily lie to them and tell them, no, I have an appointment up in Ottawa, and my supervisor, who knew my family, said, oh, all right, Tim, no problem, you know, like whatever you want, you know. So I was pretty good at playing people. My relationship was my problem at that time. You know, like I figured, yeah, you know, I'll stop doing coke and I'll dump the girlfriend at the time, and everything will be fine. They actually sent me home with a prescription of antabuse, which I was on for like about a week, and then I stopped taking that and said, okay, when's it going to be safe to drink again? I had it all mapped out, you know. Moving right along, ended that relationship that I was in. The night before I got discharged from there, I can remember being on the phone, calling the bar where I drank to talk to my girlfriend who was there, and yelling and screaming at her, and they would have tossed me out of the rehab at that point, but it was like day 28, or night 27, and day 28, and I was going home, so that was that. So I came back, like I said, started drinking again, and I stayed away from the blow for a little while, but I continued drinking, controlled drinking. Control drink. I remember one night in the bar when I got back having a wrestling match with one of my buddies. They're smoking a joint in the bar. I wanted it, and like, you know, I was gonna have it, you know. And he was down on the ground, and I was taking it out of his hand and throwing shot glasses, and it was pretty unruly. So I got into another relationship. I figured, you know, find myself a good girl. And that's where I met my my ex-wife. Met her through some friends at work. Told her, you know, like at that point, my father had just passed away. in that that spring. And, you know, I needed somebody to take care of me, you know, and this girl was, like, available. She was great. And as far as being there for my mother and helping take care of the kids while all this funeral stuff was going along. So I moved in within probably about, like, 2 months of meeting her. That was one of my big things. I would move in very quickly. I've heard people refer to it as taking hostages. Well, you know, like, I was pretty good at it. Yeah, so I'm pushing 30, time to settle down, get married. That's going to fix my life. wrong again. It was a great party. We had a beautiful wedding up in the country, great party. Got married on a bridge. It was a beautiful day, sunny, and I knew I was making a mistake. And I remember telling a friend who was fixing my tie at the time, I think I'm making a mistake. And yeah, I was, you know, I was nowhere near ready to, you know, like, settle in a relationship. And the marriage didn't last too long. That really, entire length of my relationships usually had about a 4-year shelf life. And I was able to, you know, stick in them and be all wonderful and, you know, tell them, you know, what percentage of the time that I was home and available for them and make them, you know, like, know that I was there. You know, I'm great. I cook, I clean, I can do it all, right? But when I would disappear for, you know, like 2-3 days at a time and come back in pretty sorry shape. Moving right along, the marriage failed. And then I entered into what I can call my 5-year bottoming out, my downward spiral. Within 6 months of my ex-wife leaving, I was basically living with another woman in another relationship. And I tell you, you know, the things that the women that were in relationships with me had to do, just as my drinking and drugging, progressively worse. Yeah, so my that relationship is actually what I guess moved me closer to these rooms. Eh? I was out of control, drinking and drugging, pretty steadily, drinking just about every day. My health was failing. I mean, I didn't have a solid crop for about a year, year and a half, 2 years, whatever. It was just awful. You know, I wasn't eating properly and substituting. You know, I wasn't able to work. Thought my job was the problem, you know, around all this sickness, you know, like you'd drink if you had to see what I saw. And just unable to cope or to deal with anything that was around me. And yeah, so I quit the job and went back to school, took a cabinet making course, thought that that would fix everything. And getting to school at 3:00 in the afternoon became difficult. So everything is difficult to do. The relationship was always struggling. I was never faithful in relationships except for my marriage. I never fooled around in my marriage, not when we were married. But I would often spend long hours out and, you know, I was just dishonest. And I would always blame the people that are around me for my problems. That was my deal. So what happened? Yeah, Labor Day weekend a few years ago, 2002, the relationship had been over for about a year, but we're still seeing each other off and on. And anxiety, I suffered from a lot of anxiety attacks and panic attacks, and they were more regular. I started taking medication for that and decided, well, no, the medication's not good because it's not safe to drink on. So I stopped taking the antidepressants, but I really liked the Rivotril. They gave me Rivotril for the anxiety, and that was great for coming off the blow. So there I am playing, you know, like, you know, figuring, okay, I can drink safely on this stuff for a little while, drinking not point fives, but Coors Lights and things like that, always playing that stupid game. The relationship was pretty much at the end, and the Labor Day weekend, I pretty much had a meltdown, complete and total meltdown, across some lines that I never thought that I would. I was never really a violent drunk, physically per se, but emotionally, and psychologically, I was, like, seriously abusive. I could mind fuck with the best. And, you know, like, this woman that I was with, you know, like, the push-me-pull-me relationship, I want you back, don't want you around, you know. So it was always this back-and-forth stuff. And it just didn't work. I melted down that weekend and crossed some lines. I broke into her apartment, whacked out of my mind, blacked out. I was, like, drinking. I had a sore back. So somebody gave me some Dilaudids, and I was drinking on those, and you know, I just blacked out completely, did some stupid things, you know, like those nasty phone calls in the middle of, in the, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning that I have absolutely no recollection of. I was doing shit like that, and it was pretty ugly. Luckily, she didn't call the police. She should have. Yeah, that was my bottom. I drank for a few more days, feeling sorry for myself, and one of her friends was a social worker and had passed a number along to me for Project Pride. I walked in there, and the place was supposed to be closed, but for whatever reason, this woman was still there, Ruth, and I walked in and just started crying. You know, I was miserable. You know, take myself back to that day, you know, I could, it was my bottom, God willing. Looking for smart recovery. I had this little pamphlet for smart recovery that could teach you how to drink with control. And that's what I wanted. And she said, "All recovery is smart. Why don't you come back tomorrow?" I accidentally left a cigarette pack there in her office. It had, you know, had a piece of smoke in it. And she wouldn't let me back in for it. I said, "Oh, I left my cigarettes there. Don't even take mine," you know. So I ended up following this guy Cecil to a meeting that night. He'd come in to pick up keys and for a different fellowship, and I followed him to the meeting. I was going to bolt, but I ended up calling my ex at the time, and she said, "Go to the meeting. What's the worst that could happen?" You know, and I went. I picked up a desire chip. I listened to this woman share and could really identify. Went back to, this is when things start to swing. Started showing up when I said I was going to show up. You know, I had an appointment the next day, and I showed up on time. For whatever reason, I've heard people describe it as the gift of desperation. Well, I wanted things to change. You know, I was, I wanted things to change. Sat down in an office with one of their addictions counselor, and she opened me up like a can of pop, and I was sobbing within 2 minutes. So that's something that was different, because I didn't cry a lot, eh? I wasn't a crier. You know, I was miserable, and I'd make other people cry, but I wouldn't cry myself. You know? But it started coming up, huh? She had basically had it targeted to, it was all my mother's fault. That's a good place to be, whatever, you know. But or at least I had it figured out that way. But that's where, like, a lot of, I guess, a lot of my anger at the point, that point, was directed. So I started showing up. They had addictions counselors there that I could see a couple times a week, and that was a good support. That's where I was introduced to AA again. They had this group that met there in, called 5 O'Clock Shadows, and they had daily meetings. And they said, "Why don't you go check out the meeting? I listened to this, what's his name? Big guy. This big guy sharing. Bob Fredericks, is that it? Whatever. Yeah, listen to him share, and man, you know, it was powerful stuff, and I ended up getting up and picking up the desire chip and showing up on a regular basis. It was good that the meeting, the, you know, the treatment facility or the drop-in center was there, and the meetings were there. And they were there 6 days a week at the time. So I started showing up at meetings and just listening. I can remember there was a Living Sober meeting that Mike here was chairing at the time, and I used to sit in on that and listen. And bitch and complain, I guess. Moving right along, they kind of gave me an idea of the help that was available to me at the time. I thought I needed a lot of help. I mean, like, I wasn't earning. I'm basically having anxiety attacks like you would not believe. And don't want to take, you know, Pride tells me not to take any medication for them. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I didn't want to take anything. You know, it's like I want off everything. And, you know, I toughed it out for another, I don't know, 6 weeks before Foster's took me into their day program. At this point, I'm not only am I going to Shadows on a daily basis, but I found this morning meeting at 7:30 a.m. and I started going there on a regular basis and started showing up. And there's a gentleman there, Steve, who... you know, they say that, you know, you run into people and they just show, like, a little bit of interest in you, that, you know, it's so helpful. So I'm really kind of, you know, he gave me the key to open up there. So now I have to be there because they're counting on me to basically open the place up. He had another key in his pocket and was ready for me basically to fall flat on my face, I'm sure. But, you know, I started showing up and we started doing coffee with him. I started doing coffee with him in the morning, like actually stopping at a second cup, and we'd sit there every day. And we still do it at least 3-4 times a week now, you know, 28 months later, you know, we still get up in the morning and have coffee. But I was showing up, I was putting down chairs, helping out, and, you know, just being there. And then I would zip off to my day program at Foster's and, you know, start delving into these things that, you know, like are really troubling me. They say that alcohol and the drugs are just a symptom for, like, a lot of other stuff that's been lying there and has been basically building up there for years and years and years. And I started to look into that stuff. A lot of the core family stuff. I, you know, started looking at my relationships with my mother, who I was just pissed at, you know. I think it goes back to, a lot of it for me went back to, like, childhood stuff. It's not that she was, like, an abusive, like a physically abusive woman, but just that, you know, like, the misery, a lot of times I felt responsible for her misery. And, you know, carrying that for a long time, you know, I don't feel the same way now. So I start looking at stuff. At that time, I was approached by somebody to join into a 17-week step group, and said, "Yeah." The temporary sponsor who I had at the time, who was a guy that I drank with, wasn't so keen on it. But I kind of had a sense that it was a good idea to get into working the steps, and I'm grateful to that guy for basically approaching me. You know, it was another 17-week commitment. So now commitment's in my vocabulary, and I'm showing up on a weekly basis. I'm showing up to my appointments, and yeah, that was great. That was great. It was a great way to learn about the steps. From there, I you know, did my first step three. Comes a point when we're reading through the book, and it was time to do the third step prayer. And it was suggested that everybody say the prayer any way you want, just recite the words. And, you know, I had a lot of problems with religion. I was an altar boy when I was a kid. I was raised Roman Catholic. My ideas about God at that time were, you know, pretty nasty. I turned my back on God, like, very early in my life, probably around the time that my dad got sick. I just didn't get it, you know. I blamed him, blamed the Almighty for, you know, the way things turned out. I started praying again. And it was suggested that we say this prayer on a daily basis, and I started saying the prayer. Just say it. And I had a little cue card and just said it. For whatever reason at that time, this anxiety and panic that I was suffering from left me. And it was around the time that I started praying. So I kept praying because, you know, I saw results, and I was grateful. I don't know if anybody's ever had panic attacks and anxiety attacks. But to get past that and to basically have relief from that, you know, I was grateful for, grateful, really grateful. So I continued on and continued on. I mean, yeah, a lot of resentment towards organized religion. So I just leap of faith, I just did it. step four, they suggested that we do, they're action groups. So you basically do your steps, and it was time to do a fourth step. And at this point, there's another gentleman in the step group who was like a big book thumper, and he was right into it. And my sponsor at the time wasn't so keen on me doing a fourth, thought it was too soon. He said, "No, be gentle with yourself, be gentle with yourself." And I just said, "No, no, 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 I'm moving forward here. I don't want to carry this crap anymore, and I want to start writing it out." So I started my columns, my, you know, 10, 11 pages of resentments, and did it the way they suggest in the big book, you know, and just started listing, you know, what part of self was affected, and, you know, going through the tics, acknowledging, you know, a lot of the stuff, you know, and taking, you know, becoming accountable, right? Saying, you know, there's a column there that, you know, what was my part in it. And it's funny when you start putting things down on paper, start seeing stuff, hey, you know, I'm selfish, I'm fear-driven, dishonest. It was an eye-opener. Yeah. I continued on listing my fears, never realized how fearful I was. It just says write down your fears. Even if it's not attached to any particular resentment or anything like that, just write it down, you know. And they had a prompt sheet, and it was like, check, 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 check. And that was it. It was time to sit down and talk to somebody about it, and I did that. And it was kind of funny. It wasn't so funny, a lot of the stuff. I thought my stuff was worse than everybody else's, and, you know, the shame and the guilt and everything, and I got jammed up a few times, and he was able to, you know, keep me moving forward. We actually turns out we knew some people in common. So, I remember that guy. What an asshole! Yeah, but you know, just when I was getting jammed up, you know, he kept me going. And the way he works the steps, he listed my defects of character. He had a list of 20 of them, and we went through a lot of them: the self pity, the low self esteem, the judgmentalness, negative thinking. I mean, it's just all there, you know. And said the seven-step prayer, and poof, your defects of character are going to be lifted. Eh? Wrong. Wasn't the case. But I kept moving forward, and at this point I had a list of amends. And this is all within my first like 7 or 8 months of working the program. But I'm still not necessarily feeling that great. Eh? I'm grateful to be sober at that point, and there's still like more work to be done. I was fortunate enough that I got hooked in with the Griffith House, and that's at the Montreal General Hospital, and they referred me to the psychology department there, and I got myself a good psychologist. I was fortunate enough, and I was able to sit down and start delving in more, you know, about, you know, like what was going on with me and a lot of this stuff. I found that really helpful. It's not a cure-all, you know. But it was a year in therapy to get out of therapy. I did that for like about a year, and it kind of helped me gain a little bit more of an understanding about what was going on with me, and it helped the healing process. You know, there's a lot of things that I never grieved in my life. I didn't think it was okay to show weakness and to show that, you know, like my hurt. So I often, you know, like would cover that up. It wasn't okay to show my insecurity, you know, my feelings of inferiority. I was a great chameleon in the sense that, like, a lot of people around me, you know, I put on the big, you know, everything's okay, and a lot of people, I guess, who knew me or knew a little bit about, you know, the addiction, you know, like, knew that I was a really angry guy. And, you know, it just basically helped dismantle a bomb, you know. Like, I always felt like I was going to pop sometimes, right? I like to refer to that as, you know, walking around with the pin in one hand and a grenade in the other. And, you know, I still get that way sometimes now. So moving forward, it was time to start looking at amends. And it's only been in the last, like, 6 months or so that, you know, like, I really feel that I've become effective. As far as, you know, understanding, you know, the nature of the amends, you know, like, yeah, there are a lot of the things to do. One of my things was I would take too much responsibility for a lot of stuff. A lot of times I would think that I owed amends when I didn't really, you know, because, you know, apologizing for other people's stuff, you know, isn't necessarily it. You know, the amends for me are basically becoming willing, for me is forgiveness. You know, forgiving my, you know, a lot of people talk about not putting yourself on that amends list, but, you know, I needed to forgive myself for a lot of the stuff that was going down. You know, I think there's a difference between compassion for yourself and self-pity, and, you know, trying to sort that out, went a long way to me being more willing. But yeah, I did owe amends. Just this past summer, actually, the one time that I've been to this meeting was during the summer. It was in August, right before I was going out to Calgary to see my ex-wife and my daughter. You know, I'd been clean for like just under a couple of years, and it was time to face that element. They talk a lot about your amends already start the day that you walk in this program, and actually, you know, like have an honest desire and an intention to stick. And I know it's a day at a time, but, you know, I was at the point in my program that, yeah, you know, like, I'm sticking. So I went out there, and I came to this meeting, and, you know, it was funny, it was a step nine. We're talking about step nine here. And it's funny the way things, they say that there are no coincidences, and I don't think there are. I knew, that's a step that I needed to hear. And I ended up going out there and clearing my side of the street, and for me, my amends are acknowledging, you know, the impact that, you know, my actions and my disease, my addiction, you know, had on, you know, people. And my ex-wife, for instance, was somebody who was, you know, really impacted by that. The people closest to us, eh, are the ones that, you know, we seem to hurt the most. Eh? My mother, even my father, who's been dead for like 12 years, I felt the need to basically make amends to him. And I actually went up to the grave and, you know, kind of had a talk. So, very important, you know, to make these amends, you know, these amends. 10, 11, and 12, I try to be mindful on a daily basis when I'm, you know, if I'm offside with stuff, and I try to, you know, live in those steps. Prayer and meditation have become, you know, part of my daily routine. And I just do that, you know, I just do it. You know, there's a couple, you know, periods that I might drift away a little bit, but you can always start the day that you're in, the moment that you're in. So I do try to make conscious contact with the big head, call it what you want. as far as the 12th step, when somebody calls you on a Sunday afternoon and asks you to share, you share. Putting down chairs, showing up at meetings, being willing to, you know, making yourself available. That's the way that, you know, like I got started with it, and just continuing on, getting a home group and being active in it. And that's something 5 o'clock shadows has been a cornerstone. I used to be hitting the bar for a little Sanka set action at 5 o'clock every day. Now I go to a meeting practically every day. So that's just being in the room and being willing to help. That's what it's all about. Eh? You just can't live in a shell if you want to basically get well. Ooh, that rhymed. How about that, eh? It's rolling. You know, being available, picking up the phone when it rings. You know, that's it. Getting involved down at the phones. You know, taking jobs at the group. Like, I've been the 12-step rep there for a little while, and now we didn't have a GSR, we did, but he moved on to something else, so I got involved in that. And it just puts you in the room, you know. We were having a district meeting on Thursday night, and I was looking around the room, man, and just about everybody in the room, in one way or another, has, you know, touched me in my recovery, in recovery, you know, and like I was just so grateful that night, sitting around, you know. It's a beautiful thing. The fellowship won't keep you sober, but it helps, eh? Getting right with God. This is God could and would if he were sought. I think that's, you know, the turning point, like with my anxiety, all that, and having relief from that. It's been a while since I've actually seriously entertained the thought of picking up a drink or a drug, you know, and I think that's just by working a program and being available. It's the holidays, and this month I've been kind of tuned into the energies around the room. It's a difficult time for a lot of people. It's going to be my third sober Christmas. And we talk about the gifts of sobriety, you know. My daughter's coming out day after tomorrow. You know, and that's one of my goals early on, was like reconnecting. And by, you know, working this program and starting to live right, being honest, and taking responsibility and being accountable, you know, these things happen. You know, my ex-wife's coming too. You know? But it'll be fine. Like, I'm looking forward to the holidays this year. It's a beautiful thing, and that's something I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps, and the 12 traditions, and just the fellowship. Eh? I'm a really grateful guy, and I don't think I know I couldn't have done it, you know, like without this fellowship. And the people that I've met along the way. Right? Very grateful guy. And I'd like to thank Karen for asking me this evening. And that's it.
Thanks, Tim.